Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. But now it's your turn to lift the lid and tell us your favorite story as the Box of Oddities presents Freak Family Favorites.
Hi, Kat and Jethro. This is Nick from Louisiana. I found the podcast at episode 28 and have been staying caught up ever since. My favorite story, one of my favorite stories, is the one about the kid with memories of a past life. The TV show The Ghost Inside My Child is very interesting. I've always been fascinated with reincarnation. The idea that we are reborn with a clean slate memory is intriguing. What if the memories aren't erased every time?
Today I'm pretty excited about this. This is a book I read. It was called The Boy Who Knew Too Much. It came out last year. It's written by author Kathy Bird.
Oh, yeah.
And you remember me talking about this?
I do.
Yeah. She claims, and so does her son, that he is the reincarnated spirit of baseball legend Lou Gehrig.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I saw the book and I'm like, baseball and reincarnation, I'm in.
You know, I did a project on reincarnation when I was in sixth grade.
You did?
Yeah, I had to make a poster. And so I modeled it after the recycling signs that were becoming so popular then. So I did like a recycle your soul kind of deal.
Oh, wow.
But I misspelled soul.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was kind of embarrassing.
Like sole of a shoe?
Yeah.
Did they take points off for that?
Oh, yeah.
For those of you who maybe aren't baseball fans, even if you aren't, I know you've heard of Lou Gehrig. Lou Gehrig was, his nickname was the Iron Horse. Here are some of his stats according to Wikipedia. Major League Baseball player, New York Yankees from 1923 till 1939. Gehrig was renowned for his prowess as a hitter. He was a seven-time All-Star, seven consecutive seasons, a Triple Crown winner, an American League Most Valuable Player two different times, a member of six World Series championship teams along with Babe Ruth. He played with Babe Ruth. He had a lifetime batting average of .340, and he hit 493 home runs. He was a legend.
Why do they call him the Iron Horse?
Because he played something like 3,000 consecutive games without taking a day off.
What's that got to do with horses?
Iron horse. You know, an iron horse is like a train. They used to call trains iron horse back in the day. And so he just kept going.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Why did they call trains iron horses? Oh, because they were transportation, made of metal?
Yeah. I think it was a Native American thing.
Oh.
Gehrig died in 1941. Now, here's an article by ESPN. They said, did he come back? And then he goes on to talk about Kathy Bird believing her son, Christian Haupt, is the reincarnated spirit of Lou Gehrig.
Wow.
And there are a lot of things to make you question whether or not this is this could be true. It's actually quite persuasive.
That's good. It'll need to be because you know how I feel about this kind of thing.
This is the part that's going to be a little bit different. I actually got Kathy Bird on the phone. By the way, she's a wonderful lady.
Okay.
I really enjoy talking with her. And
really?
And she
really enjoyed it? You really enjoyed it?
Yes. Yes.
Listen, Kathy.
No, it's nothing like that.
Just kidding.
But she's without a question of a doubt convinced that her son is the reincarnated spirit of Lou Gehrig. When I talked to her, I had her explain some things. I'm going to play some clips of the conversation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
She explained when he started talking about being Lou Gehrig, what it was like.
When he did start talking about Lou Gehrig, it was right around the time that he turned 3 is when he started saying things to us like, "Mommy, I used to be a tall baseball player." You know, and I would say, "Yeah, you're going to be tall someday. You'll be a tall baseball player." And one day he got so upset with me and stomped his foot and said, "No, I was tall like Daddy." And I said, "You mean you were a grown-up?" And he said, "Yes." So from then on is when it really kind of opened Pandora's box, and he just kept telling us more and more things about this lifetime as a baseball player.
And I think it's important to note that at like 2 or 3 years old, he was a baseball prodigy.
Oh, wow.
This kid can play ball. He's considered to be one of the best ball players for his age in the country.
Oh, my goodness.
He's on traveling baseball teams. He has been for years. He threw out the first pitch at Dodger Stadium. You can see that on YouTube. And he was really young, like 4.
Well, that's just cool.
And he threw a strike. He wound up like a Major League Baseball player and threw a strike.
At how old?
4.
That's mind-blowing.
Yeah, and the crowd of 30,000 people just went nuts.
I would imagine.
Yeah, check it out. It's on YouTube. Now, one of the things that I knew about, because I'm a baseball history buff, one of the things that I knew about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig's relationship was that most people think it was a great, strong camaraderie, and it was for a while, but they did have a falling out.
Oh, no.
At one point.
Why?
In their
Babe,
career.
Why?
Well, she talks a little bit about when she found out that Christian did not like Babe Ruth.
That happened when we filmed the movie in Boston with Adam Sandler, and I took him to see the Yankees play the Red Sox at Fenway Park, and there was this giant picture of Babe Ruth, and Christian saw it when he was 2 years old and got so upset, like had a huge emotional reaction to this photo where he was waving his little bat and said, "I don't like him. He was mean to me." And at the time, that was really strange. It was before he started telling us things about another lifetime. But I couldn't really put my finger on it. And then, you know, as time went by, he continued to harbor this grudge towards Babe Ruth. So I showed him pictures of the 1927 Yankees at the suggestion of Carol Bowman, who is a woman I found who actually studies past life memories of children. She wrote a book about it, and she consults with parents who have similar experiences to mine. And she told me to show him photos of Babe Ruth's teams that he played with. And that's when I asked Christian, "Do you see anyone else in this photo who doesn't like Babe Ruth?" And Christian continued to point at a guy with dimples who turned out to be Lou Gehrig. But this animosity towards Babe Ruth, like, he still isn't a big fan of Babe Ruth. He's still so, "I don't like him." And as he got older, he said things like, "Babe Ruth was a very jealous man." You know, he would get into the story behind it. And what I later found out, once Christian saw a picture of Lou Gehrig and said, "That's me," and told us other things about the life of Lou Gehrig, I later found out that Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth had this falling out, that they were very good friends, and they had a falling out that led them not to speak, basically for the entire 7 years, last 7 years of Lou Gehrig's career on the Yankees. They were really good friends. I did so much research on this. Once Christian kept telling me things, now I know everything there is to know about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig, so they were very good friends, like to the point that Lou Gehrig's mother actually took Babe Ruth into her home and took care of him after he got divorced. But they did have a big falling out, and Christian, ironically, was the one who shared that with me, what the falling out was about, and as I researched it more, he was actually right. And so what happened is once they had this falling out, they really didn't speak, but there are a lot of pictures of them together, and there's actually that one famous picture when Lou Gehrig gives his luckiest man speech on his retirement day at Yankee Stadium, where Babe Ruth actually puts his arm around Lou Gehrig, and that's considered to be their reconciliation, where they hadn't spoken for 7 years. That's kind of historically looked upon as a reconciliation.
Now, the thing that that made them enemies toward the end was, and I found this out, I researched this myself, apparently they were on a ship together, and Lou Gehrig found Babe Ruth in the same room with his wife.
Oh, and Babe Ruth was kind of well known for being
A drunken womanizer.
Right. I was trying to think of a nice way to say that, but yeah, no, he was just, he would grab at whatever parts.
Yeah. And so they had a falling out, and for 7 years, he hated Babe Ruth, and I understand that, sure. But they were good friends leading up to that, and then reconciled that day that she mentioned at Yankee Stadium, where he gave that famous speech.
I'm looking at the hug right now. Oh, yeah. That's kind of sweet. You can tell Babe Ruth is into it, and Lou Gehrig's kind of like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I suppose.
He's letting it happen, sure. But he's still a little apprehensive about it.
Yeah. Kathy took Christian to Lou Gehrig's house in New York.
Was he home?
He was not home. He'd been dead since 1941. Okay. But the people who lived there brought them in, and Christian went through the house and told everybody where everything was. He knew the house backwards and forwards. He made all kinds of comments about, I used to sit here, this was my bedroom, you know, these kinds of things that he couldn't have known, but were later verified.
Oh, wow.
That's true.
That's pretty interesting.
Now, I mentioned that he is a bit of a baseball prodigy, and he became friends at a very early age with Tommy Lasorda, who is a legendary Hall of Fame.
Right. He was the Weight Watchers guy.
Yeah. He did that too.
Yep.
Yeah. But he was the manager for the Dodgers for years and years and years. And he just happened to see Christian hitting wiffle balls in the parking lot outside of Dodger Stadium and pulled Kathy aside and said, that kid's special. That kid has something.
Oh, that's cool.
And ever since then, he's invited Christian to go to spring training games for the Dodgers. There's also a video of him on YouTube throwing a baseball to Clayton Kershaw, Cy Young winner.
Oh.
And throwing a strike right at him. And the guy's like, oh, my God. He couldn't believe it was coming from this young kid. I think with being a Red Sox fan, we need to make sure that we draft him when he's old enough.
I love how you're really thinking about how we can make this work in our interest.
Yeah. So Kathy talked a little bit about when she started taking him seriously, because at first, you know, you're going, well, kids have imaginations and that sort of thing.
Well, I was the biggest skeptic of all. Like when Christian would tell me these things, even when I pretended to go along with it, I was still questioning, like, what is this? And the first thing I did was go to my pastor and shared with him the things that Christian had said. And the pastor basically insinuated that Christian could be possessed by the spirit of a dead person. And this was obviously, as a mother, not something you want to hear. So that's when I took the more scientific route and looked for other answers. But it really was one thing he said to me when he had just turned 3 and we were in an elevator. And he said, Mommy, this elevator kind of looks like a hotel. And I said, yeah, it kind of does. And he said, when I was a tall baseball player, when I was tall like Daddy, I used to stay in hotels almost every night. And I kind of went along with it. And I said, oh, did you travel on airplanes? I mean, and he said, no, mostly trains. And at that point, it was so strange to me. I didn't even know if baseball players really traveled on trains at the time during Babe Ruth's era. But it just was strange to me because Christian had never played with trains, never been on a train. I don't think we'd ever talked about trains. So I looked it up and found out that Babe Ruth did travel on trains. And then as things began to become more and more confirmed through history as I would look them up on the internet is when it kind of sucked me in, like, okay, there's something to this.
In her book, she also talks about how he was interviewed by some medical experts in this area and children that have that claim to have lived past lives and asked him some specific questions, asked him about, well, did you know your mother in a past life? And he claims that Kathy was his mother, was Lou Gehrig's mother as well.
Oh.
And so Kathy was like, yeah, I don't know about that.
Right.
So Kathy went and had a hypnotic regression herself. And sure enough, she could see things that were taking place. She could see the home that she lived in. And later, when they went to visit Lou Gehrig's home, she recognized it.
Interesting.
As being what she saw in her hypnotic vision.
Gotcha.
But there were a lot of different things that led them to believe that this could possibly be the case. I went and looked at a side-by-side video comparison of Christian, who is left-handed, like Gehrig was, swinging a baseball bat. Because, you know, each baseball player has their own style, has
sure.
their own swing.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's just like the same thing. It's the same swing. You look at Christian's left-handed swing and Lou Gehrig's left-handed swing, and it's the same swing. It's exactly the same. And this kid's been doing it since he was like four.
Right. And that was before they started really researching Lou Gehrig.
Yes.
That his swing kind of started that to be that style.
That's right.
I gotcha.
These doctors and people who study these cases of kids, there are cases where kids come through with scars on them. Like, for example, if someone was like shot in the head, they'll have a scar right where that bullet wound was. With Christian, they're physical things. Like, he has big, deep dimples, just like Lou Gehrig, which isn't like a real characteristic of our family. But so that was kind of a fun thing. But obviously, anyone could have dimples. He's left-handed, like Lou Gehrig was left-handed. We noticed when Christian was about four, I watched a video that I had shot of a travel baseball game that he was playing in. Believe it or not, he played travel baseball at 4 years old. I know. Wow. That's strange. And I compared it to videos of Lou Gehrig, and his form was quite similar, like his swing and the way he would slide into the bases. He would take his helmet off at home plate and kind of wave it like Lou Gehrig would wave his hat at the crowd. Just little subtle things that we would pick up on.
Now, he's still doing travel baseball, and he's still considered to be, well, he is, one of the best baseball players in his age group in the country, if not in the world. It's really an amazing thing to watch. And I was, Kathy's a Facebook friend of mine, mm-hmm. and she had posted recently something about they were at this competition, and one of the other team's players' father was taunting him, was making fun of Christian being the reincarnated spirit of Lou Gehrig.
Like how?
Just taunting him.
What do you mean?
Yelling out words and making fun.
Teasing him. Words and making fun.
Yeah.
Like in general or saying things about Lou Gehrig?
Saying things about Christian claiming to be, okay, Lou Gehrig, let's see if you can hit, you know, that kind of
thing. Gotcha.
I mean, I wasn't there, but that's how I pictured it in my head.
Okay.
And so I asked her about how he deals with that, because now everybody knows
right.
that he believes that he's Lou Gehrig. How does he deal with that? And she says he's incredibly mature for his age, and it just rolls off his back. And he's like, I just want to play baseball.
Aww.
He's a good kid. Now, at one point, and this is getting kind of weird, Kathy took Christian and his sister to visit Lou Gehrig's grave.
I think there's a video in the book trailer. We did a book trailer that Jack Canfield narrated, and there's also a little video of that moment, too. And it really was a very special, special time, getting on that airplane and leaving New York. And, you know, it was just a really sense of closure for Christian. There was a lot of reverence. And even my daughter, who used to make fun of him, she used to actually get him all wound up because she would call him Babe Ruth, and he would come after her, and he would try to pull her hair. And, you know, but even my daughter in that moment, she knew that that was special.
What was going through your mind when you were watching that? I mean, that's a pretty big thing.
You know, I mean, it seems strange to bring your six-year-old son to a grave, right? It was definitely something. It was something that was so deep in his soul and so much a part of his reality. We had just spent a couple weeks in Cooperstown right before we went to the grave, where Christian was at the Hall of Fame Museum and got to see like Lou Gehrig's old uniforms and his locker and trophies. And, you know, so it was really kind of a deep emotional experience. We went to the home of Lou Gehrig. We walked through the home. We got to, you know, be in the place where Lou Gehrig used to live, you know. And that Christian actually did say when we were out on the patio there that the house that Lou Gehrig lived in and bought for his parents in 1927, Christian said, we were standing on the patio, and he said, Babe Ruth used to smoke here, which was kind of funny. But that moment at the graveyard and just being at the grave and was just so special. And one cute thing Christian said as we were flying home to Los Angeles was there were a bunch of balls all over Lou Gehrig's grave. And then Christian said, I hope when I die, I get a lot of balls on my grave.
The kid is incredibly well-adjusted for the spotlight that he's been standing in. When he threw out the first pitch at 4 years old in front of 30,000 people, she said that he was just as comfortable as can be.
That's really cool.
And he just quietly goes about his business, which is to become the best baseball player he can. And he is, you know, as I've said, considered to be one of the best at his age group. So it's an interesting story, and it's one that you can't discount. And if you read the book, there are a lot more examples of things that really kind of point to this as being a very strong possibility. They actually found a couple who Lou Gehrig's mother lived with before she passed away, and they were able to verify a lot of the information that Christian had told them about Lou Gehrig and his mother at that time. And you'll just have to get the book and check it out for yourself. It's it's called The Boy Who Knew Too Much. It is soon to be a major motion picture. 20th Century Fox optioned
it. Oh, that's cool.
And they're doing the screenplay right now. And earlier in the interview, she talked a little bit about being a Christian and going to church to talk to her pastor about this, and her pastor saying, well, he might be possessed by the spirit of a dead person. And that kind of freaked her out a little bit.
Yeah.
And so she had to pull back a little bit from that. And I asked her how she kind of dealt with it. And she said that, and I love this, she said, what this has taught me is that we're all just souls in a human body, and that we're all the same, and that we all just need to love each other.
I can definitely get on board with that sentiment.
I asked her to kind of sum things up a little bit at the end of the conversation.
You know, one thing I would just love to impress on people, the book is called The Boy Who Knew Too Much. It came out in March 2017. What I really encourage people to do is, rather than make a snap judgment, please read the book, because a lot of people, I've been getting message after message, letters of people whose lives have really been changed by it, and especially people who have lost a loved one. People who've lost a child, lost a parent, lost a sibling. The book really gives them hope and that connection to that person who's passed away.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you talked about it a lot and then ended up getting in contact with this woman. So it obviously, you know, rung something in you. I don't even know what I mean to say. It obviously touched something in you.
The idea of reincarnation has always been fascinating to me. I just read an account of somebody who had a hypnotic regression to a life that they had as a soldier in World War I, where he describes how he died, and he died from gunfire in the battle, and where he was shot and how he laid there for hours dying slowly. And in this life, he suffers from, or had suffered from, migraine headaches in the exact same spot that he found out through hypnotic regression, or that it was suggested, the same spot where he was shot.
Right.
You know, and like she said, you know, a lot of times people will be born with birthmarks and things of wounds that they died from or had in previous lives. So that's all very fascinating to me. And being a baseball history nut, this just seemed like right in my wheelhouse.
Kind of just converged into the ultimate Jethro, you know, fan.
Yep. It was
story.
It was everything. I read it in two nights. I just couldn't put it down. It was just fascinating. And I have to say, I don't discount it. I think that
I can tell.
There's a lot of a lot of evidence that to me suggests that there's more to this than we know.
Sure. And you know me, I don't pretend to know the answers. I most often will be very skeptical about almost everything to the point that annoys you sometimes. But, you know, I can't say that it's not true.
You hear Kat and I talk a lot about Aura frames, and there's a reason for that. We live in Ecuador and our family is all over the place. In fact, Kat right now is up visiting her mom. And when I say up, I mean Maine. We got her an Aura frame so we could share photos and videos from any device, and they'll instantly appear on the frame, which makes it easy because she's getting up there in years. It's easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app, and it's the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app, and if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. It is the perfect gift for Mother's Day. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get 30% off free shipping and their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com. Use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. That's A-U-R-A, frames.com, and use code ODDITIES at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerge will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
The Box of Oddities with Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth.
Hey Kat and JG, my name is Adam and I currently live in the Western Hemisphere. My favorite Box of Oddities story is the bizarre tale of Dybbuk boxes, that weird cabinet that's part junk drawer, part evil spirit bachelor pad? I don't know. Anyway, you haven't done an update on the story, but I think maybe those other two boxes have been found. You should check it out.
I have a question for you.
I love questions.
What is a Dybbuk box?
A Dybbuk box. Isn't that where you keep spirits?
Yeah, it is. It's a box that some say has entrapped a Dybbuk.
Wasn't Hellraiser loosely based on that concept?
There were a number of movies that are based on the Dybbuk box. A Dybbuk comes from traditional Jewish mysticism and is a malicious spirit believed to be the dislocated soul of a dead person. The term first appeared in several writings from the 16th century. It's associated with demonic possession. It possesses its victims and will only leave the host body once it's accomplished its goal or has been exorcised.
Okay.
Dybbuks tend to be male spirits.
I didn't know that specifically. That's neat.
Traditionally, they possessed women on the eve of their weddings, typically in a sexual fashion.
Oh.
By entering the woman through their vaginas.
Okay. I'm gonna go ahead and say not cool.
The Dybbuk box is used to trap and contain the Dybbuk, separating and isolating it to prevent it from possessing anyone or doing any harm. There are reportedly 10 Dybbuk boxes around the world, and it's claimed that 8 of them are found.
Oh.
The legend goes that if all 10 are found and opened, releasing the Dybbuk, it would bring such pain and suffering on the world as never been before seen.
Very Pandora's box-ish.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The most famous Dybbuk box is a wine cabinet that was purchased in 2001 by a furniture refinisher named Kevin Manis. He purchased it at an estate sale with the idea of fixing it up as a gift for his mom.
Oh, that's nice.
The estate sale was at the home of a Holocaust survivor. When he purchased the cabinet, the Holocaust survivor's granddaughter said, "Oh, you bought the Dybbuk box." It was then that she explained the history of this particular piece of furniture.
I just checked, and apparently Hellraiser is not connected to Dybbuk's. My bad. I just got real excited because it's nearly Halloween and it's time for me to bring out my Chatterer costume.
I know. It's the most magical time of year.
Mm-hmm.
So the cabinet was purchased in Spain by a woman who had escaped a German concentration camp. She ultimately immigrated to the United States, bringing with her the Dybbuk box. It was her wish to be buried when she passed away with the Dybbuk box. But because it conflicted with Jewish tradition, her family did not honor that wish, and the box was sold at this estate sale. So Kevin takes the wine cabinet / Dybbuk box back to his shop to fix it up. When he opened it up, he found some very strange things inside. The Dybbuk box contained a golden wine chalice, a candlestick holder with tentacle legs, a dried rosebud, 2 locks of hair bound in old pieces of ribbon, 2 1920s wheatback pennies. I know, I thought that would interest you. A stone with the Hebrew word shalom engraved on it. Of course, that's the Hebrew word for peace. And the Shema prayer carved into the wood. Now, the Shema prayer is the cornerstone of the Jewish morning and evening prayers. As soon as Kevin took possession of it, weird things started to happen. One day at his shop, while he was out running some errands, the security gates came crashing down and locked his employee inside the basement. Just as that happened, all of the light bulbs in the basement exploded.
Ooh, I don't like that.
Understandably, the clerk quit.
If
I get locked in a basement, if gates come slamming down and lock me in the basement and all the light bulbs explode at the same time, I'm in the wrong profession. Kevin did ultimately give the cabinet to his mother for her birthday.
Okay. You have this box of nightmares.
Yes. And she immediately suffered a stroke.
Oh, no.
She told Kevin she did not want it in her house.
Oh, I hope Kevin didn't take that personally.
I'm sure he didn't. He took it back to his place. That's about the time when he started having nightmares of being beaten repeatedly by a dark cloaked figure that he interpreted as looking like a demonic hag. When he would wake up from these nightmares, he would often have bruises on his body.
Ooh.
On one occasion, his sister came to visit at his house, and she experienced the same nightmare while staying there. So at this point, Kevin decided, I'm going to sell this Dybbuk box.
Yeah.
And he listed it on eBay in 2003. Now, we've all heard all kinds of stories about haunted mason jars and various artifacts that were supposed to be haunted, selling for ridiculous amounts of money on eBay. But the Dybbuk box was not one of them. It only sold for about $148, which is less than he paid for it at the estate sale.
But he was happy to just get rid of it.
Yeah, so it would seem. The person who bought it was a man named Losef Nitschke. He was a student studying at Truman State University in Missouri. Weird things started happening immediately to Losef. He brought the box into his apartment, and all the lights burned out at the same time. And then his hair began to fall out.
Ooh.
So it wasn't long before he said, yeah, I'm going to get rid of this too.
I'm good.
And he gave the box to a museum director by the name of James Haxton. Mr. Haxton, being a museum director, took an academic approach to the Dybbuk box. He tried very hard to understand exactly what it was. He interviewed several rabbis and was able to track down the Dybbuk box's original owner, the descendants of the Holocaust survivor.
Okay.
His thought was that it was some sort of a prayer altar. Now, Haxton began to experience his own misfortunes.
Oh, no.
Once he took possession of the Dybbuk box, the very day it arrived at his place, a huge tree fell on his house and nearly destroyed the entire building.
Oof.
His vision unexplainably started to deteriorate, nearly rendering him blind. He also started developing big red welts all over his body.
Oh, gosh.
But the weirdest thing that happened, and this creeps me out the most, he put it in a room in his house, and the wall right behind the Dybbuk box began to swarm with venomous centipedes.
Ew, no!
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh, I don't like that.
So in an attempt to contain the negative energy, he built a sacred container known as an ark, like the Ark of the Covenant.
Sure.
It was made of acacia wood and gold, and he put the Dybbuk box inside the sacred ark container and put the ark inside a military-style shipping crate. Its next stop is where you can see the Dybbuk box today. It's currently on display in its own exhibit room at the Haunted Museum in Las Vegas, which is owned by famed ghost hunter Zach Bagans.
Zach Bagans.
Yep. He buys all that
just
weird.
Looking up Zach Bagans stuff like yesterday. It's so weird.
He buys all kinds of weird shit. He bought the cauldron that Ed Gein used to boil the bodies down. I think he bought Annabelle, the doll Annabelle.
Yeah.
I'll have to double check on that.
But
he buys all this crap and he puts it in his museum. And it continues to mystify. In the walls around the Dybbuk box at the Haunted Museum, protruding holes began to appear in the walls, almost as if something was trying to break out from within the exhibit.
Oof.
That's according to a spokesman for the museum. In addition, several people have claimed to have seen a black cloaked figure passing by the door of the exhibit room, and it doesn't matter whether the museum is open or closed. According to author and investigator Charles Moss, in an article he wrote for Input Magazine, he received an email from Zach Bagans that said, quote,
Since owning the Dybbuk box, there have been countless documented experiences people have had with it. Not just with myself, but my museum staff, my fellow crew members, visitors, and most notably, Post Malone.
Post Malone?
Yeah.
How was he connected to this?
Well, he was there for a taping with Zach Bagans, and he touched the Dybbuk box, and things started going really bad for him in a hurry.
Oh, no.
During an appearance on Late Night with Seth Meyers, he said, quote, "We opened up this creepy Dybbuk box. I got into a car accident. I almost had a plane wreck, and my house was broken into. All types of weird stuff, all within a month's time. It was really, really odd stuff."
Huh.
Bagans also claims that multiple guests have been severely affected in the Dybbuk box exhibition room in the museum, to the point where some have had to be escorted out on a stretcher by EMT personnel.
My goodness.
Now, I think energy can attach to items. I'm not saying it's intelligent energy.
Sure.
Necessarily, but I often wonder about that energy that may have attached to old historic places and objects. There have been countless claims of items purchased at estate sales and antique shops like jewelry that have had some sort of negative aura about them. I myself have seen old items at like a museum or something, and I've had this sense or feeling of sorrow or foreboding that comes from them.
Yeah, I've had that happen with people.
Yes. Yeah. It's just, it's an aura. It's a feeling you can
Ma'am,
get.
Ma'am, you are dork.
I tell myself it's my imagination, but I really don't believe me. My source information, Input Magazine, NME.com, Wikipedia, and History Magazine, the Dybbuk box.
Very interesting.
There are very few things that scare me more than the idea of demonic entities. Like if it's a monster or something, I figure I can run away.
Sure.
You know, I got a shot.
Okay. You know?
But if it's a spirit, for me, I just feel totally defenseless.
Yeah. That's how I feel when my phone rings. Like, I just text me. Why are
yeah,
you
yeah, I understand
doing
that.
This to me
exactly.
emotionally?
And so, would you like to host your own segment and share your favorite box of oddity story? Just record on your smartphone who you are, where you're from, what your favorite story is, and why, and anything else you'd like to share. Then email it to curator@theboxofoddities.com. Copyright 2024. All rights reserved.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Hello everyone, it's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.